Letterboxd Pixie, show you what to do, and this is what he'll tell you. If you got a problem, to know who you are here now, this is what you do. Remember, you are me, I am you, all of us together.
With simplicity, all that happens to you, and welcome to the Naked Short Club on Resonance FM. I am Dr. Stu, your host. With me, expert guests here from their respective tax havens. As usual, no preset agenda. We'll pretend to be banks who, unlike hedgies, can't really go bust and freeform it. But for sure, we're going to talk dirty about hedge funds, the markets, the wider world, and we'll celebrate plutocracy, Cameron's fantasy privilege spreader, and Mitt's broader magic 53. So if you're a scrounging 47er, you're just part of the mob. Go and get a proper job. But no, the millions don't flow easy in this Roro world full of twists and tunnels. Speaking of which, we're coming to you live from beneath the bridge on the Serpentine Boating Lake in London's Hyde Park, panning for Alpha. The oars have dropped from the gunwales, and we're drifting like so many hedge funds still below their high water marks. Now, the emollient of an uncertain world creates both opportunities and chasms of the unexpected, and those of us that trade, who are still human, must also second-guess not just our own natures as part of the crowd, but also the ghosts within the machines, high-frequency or otherwise, that now represent so much of the markets. And for all the fans talk, the less alpha we see, the more it all seems to be just a random walk. Anyway, this speculation is thirsty work, so before we introduce our guests, let's ask our master engineer, Mr. Chris Dixon, what should we have to drink when we return to shore?
Why, it's got to be more of the products of our sponsors, made of premium Ponzi beer.
Yes, sir. Tastes so strong, you won't see daylight for 150 years. Now, our guests, try to get those oars back without upending the boat. And tell me, how are you dressed?
We're naked, Dr. Stu.
And too rich to care what you wear, as long as you don't need to share your dosh with the 99%ers, the great unwashed. Now, this is not Alphaholics Anonymous, even if some of you in this week's group session have closet beta issues. We've got Gus Black, partner, Deckerts, Neil Wilson, managing editor, Eurohedge, Richard Edwards, CEO, Head Capital, Simon Fox, principal, Mercer, Jonathan Foyer, managing partner, CVC Partners, one of our private equity sistren and brethren, plus Minister Plenipotentiary, Cucina Verde, Bever Lee, and novelist Aita Igodaro. Now, before business pleasure, each of you take one of these Dr. Stu's proprietary alpha pills. They'll make you feel good and add basis points to your returns. In the meantime, Mr. Chris Dixon, let's have some music.
In case you don't remember, this is what you do. Get up out of bed now. If there's nothing left to find an answer to, believe. it. Don't you ever wonder if it's really true? Do you question them? Really, that's the
Naked Short Club on Resonance FM, coming to you live from the Locust and Speculator pub of choice in London's hedgy heartland, Mayfair. Pints of the brew of our sponsors, Madoff Ponzi Beer, lined up foaming on the bar, like so many well-run companies and sovereigns just waiting to be swallowed. Anyway, before we put on our first trade, Aita Igodaro has something important for our listeners. Aita.
Yes, Dr. Stu, there is so much trouble and trauma out there. So lines are open to the Emergency Hedge Fund Helpline on 1-800-DISTRESSED. Magnus, Jerome and Alan on switchboard await your calls. Please note, however, that lines are soft closed. Strictly hedgies only, please.
Thanks, Aita. But things for some are so bad that we're happy to speak to anyone in the broader alternative space. Private equity, risk parity, real assets, real estate, all styles. And also we do have one of our private equity sister and brethren here. So, listeners, let's hear from you. I am Dr. Stu, you're calling and I'm listening. Now, let's make some money. So, Richard Edwards, what's happened or is happening that's of interest?
Well, I was on holiday, Dr. Stu, and I get a little bored lying by my swimming pool, watching my yacht sail around in it. And my mind turned to economics, which, as you know, is too important to be left to economists. And the subject that bethought me was that of quantitative easing. And as you all know, my fellow hedgies, there's been a huge amount of money sprayed at the markets lately by central banks in America, the United Kingdom, the European Central Bank, Japan, and to some extent China. And there is very little consensus as to what's going to happen as a result of this. Those who worry that it's going to result in inflation have had the upper hand in the argument lately. And I thought of this, and I thought some more, and I thought they're probably looking in the wrong direction because the consensus is almost always wrong. So pondering it a bit more, I thought, let's have a think about cycles. Now, our view of business cycles is that they only exist because the natural tendency for economies to grow collides with the job of the central bank, which is to stop things getting out of hand. So growth occurs, the economy heats up, the central bank tightens, growth cools too much, the central bank has to loosen, stimulate, and so you get a cycle. You get the central bank and the economy chasing each other up and down in a 4 to 6 year cycle. This happens more in America than anywhere else, but everybody's used to talking about the business cycle. And that, in my view, is what causes it, the collision between natural economic growth and the activities of the central bank trying to keep things calm. And that, despite the whining of people who can't bear any kind of pain, has been a reasonably stable, has produced a reasonably stable universe since probably 1945. There have been recessions caused by other than tightening, but usually it's a spontaneous thing which is caused by the central bank.
Would you actually say that on the whole that really hasn't been the primary driver of the recessions that have been experienced? It's been exogenous shocks or just the cycle?
No, I think that it is the internal dynamic that I just described which causes most recessions. I mean, there are oil shocks, there are wars, and so on. But this undulation, this business cycle, which has led to a great deal of prosperity, really, because, as that famous Austrian economist said, it's the creative destruction aspect of capitalism which causes the renewal, which leads to greater prosperity.
Oh, and you mean that Schumpeter fellow?
That Schumpeter fellow, yeah. Okay. Long dead now.
Mm-hmm.
So I was thinking of this, lying on my sunbed, and I thought, well, what's different now? And, of course, we've recently had a major economic collapse. We had, to take you back to the summer of 2008, where truck production in Europe fell by 90% for two consecutive months. And everybody thought we were staring into the abyss. And so central banks and any other monetary authority other than a central bank started pouring money into the system. And to some extent, they still do. They started, they stopped, they started again. And this money printing, or now we have to call it quantitative easing because it's all done through electronics, has been at a remarkable pace, truly remarkable, unprecedented pace.
But I'd be interested to know later, when we throw this open to discussion, whether you think this is going to lead to inflation, as many do.
Well,
or
I think that's the consensus view. But what I think is going to happen is that the normal function of the central bank, which is to take this controlling this controlling posture when things get out of hand, has been completely distorted by this panic, this trying to keep the wolf from the door at all costs by spraying unconscionable amount of money at the markets. May result in inflation. But what I think it will certainly result in is a dramatic widening of the cycle. So we're going to see perhaps the same periodicity, perhaps it'll still be a 5, 6, 7 year cycle, but the highs and lows will be much more dramatic.
Almost Victorian style, if you will.
Yes, conceivably. Yeah.
Interesting. Great. We will come back to this later. But in the meantime, the same question to Neil Wilson. What's been happening or is happening that you find of interest?
Well, thanks for having me back on, Dr. Stu.
Pleasure.
It's been a while. And I think my opening comments...
Well, it's only because you spent so much time this summer refurbishing your estate down by Nice, but there you are.
I thought I'd begin my comments just talking
okay,
about...
Okay, Cap Ferrat, western side. Go on.
Talking about the... I wish, yes. Talking about the hedge fund industry itself and its health or otherwise and what we see. And what we see, I think, is the number of new fund launches being fewer, especially in Europe. Though with a steady pipeline ahead. Performance being weak, especially in Asia until the last month or so. But the industry assets being surprisingly robust, up again in the first half and still well over $2 trillion. And so I was wondering about what the lessons of that would be, and maybe these are points that we can return to later in the discussion. But it seems to me that despite the performance being weak, and when I say weak, the composites 4.5% or less for the year, when the S&P is up 16. But investors don't seem to be running away. Many seem to be happy with the downside protection, at least for now. Maybe that's something Simon will want to comment on. My take on that is that it reflects the fact that there's more institutional money in the industry, more pension funds and so forth. And what that means for the industry is that it's a market where the big are getting bigger, where there's more operational and regulatory requirements and so higher barriers to entry. It's a market where it's a challenge to survive if you're a fund of funds, but where there's a lot more power for the consultants who are advising those big-end investors who are coming in. What it means, going back to the new funds, is that, we only had 37 in Europe in the first half. In the heyday of the industry, we had 100 every first half.
When you published that figure earlier this year, Dr. Stu was absolutely astonished. I mean, truly.
Yeah. Although I think, as my colleague Nick Evans said in his commentary on it, that it was a very high quality 37 funds. In the old days, there used to be a lot of people that would start a fund with a small amount of money and have a go and see if they could build a track record and attract assets that way. We don't see many people having a go like that anymore.
No, you're getting a lot of people who sort of get stuck at the point of intending to launch but not quite getting around
to it.
Well,
it's a scary thing to do with a small amount of assets because your fixed costs are much higher now.
So, I'm sure people like Gus doing the work that they do by day see that all the time.
So you only see people with serious amounts of money bothering to start, I think, is the lesson there.
Yeah, the bar's risen so high.
Yeah. So those are my opening comments.
Well, that's excellent. Thanks for that, Neil. Now, I'm going to ask exactly the same question of John in a second, but also I'm going to ask all of you guests, what do you call an unemployed hedge fund manager? Well, a yacht owner, of course. Anyway, John, same question for you. What's going on that you're interested in?
No, I mean, it's very interesting to listen to the current views of the returns that have been achieved the last couple of years. And I think the real question for the industry is, you're charging alpha, the incentive fees, are you actually making alpha? That's the real question. Most of the funds do not have hurdles, which frankly I think is not aligned to the investor's position. So I think what you're going to see is just a proliferation of the issues that certain funds are going to have to shut down or restructure themselves over time. And fundraising will be the focus on that. You're getting the same pressures as in the private equity funds, only the quality funds will survive, the quality firms will survive, because it's a flight to stability as much as anything else. And I think, you know, investors can choose, and they will choose. So I think, you know, I'm not saying the asset class will shrink, but the number of players will naturally shrink. And I think that's inevitable in all industries as they mature. This is no different here.
Cool. John, we'll talk about this some more later on. But first, what's up, Ayuta?
Well, Dr. Stu, lines to the emergency hedge fund helpline on 1-800-DISTRESSED are red hot. Raj and Tom on switchboard can barely cope.
Thanks, Ayuta. There is pain aplenty out there. And to callers like Saeed Pocket from Damascus and, for that matter, CDS and his brother O from Bahrain, all we can say is keep up the good fight and keep those calls coming, listeners. Now, let's see. Simon Fox, what's going on that you find interesting?
Hi, good evening, Dr. Stu. I wanted to pick up on some of the comments made about the state of the industry and how it's evolving at the moment. As Neil pointed out, there's still a flow of institutional money coming into the hedge fund space. And I think the sort of chronic underweight to the hedge fund universe from institutional investors will mean that's likely to continue for the foreseeable future. But having said that, Dr. Stu, I find it fascinating that hedge funds remain so unloved by the general public. And that really since 2008, they've failed to capture the imagination of investors.
I mean, what is that? Performance fee envy or what?
Well, I think there are a number of number of things that go into it. Before I comment on that, Dr. Stu, what I thought was interesting was the study that came out this week by the Economist Intelligence Unit from State Street. And they showed how institutional investors are looking to manage their portfolios through the volatile markets that we find ourselves in. And what I think is interesting as someone that tries to talk to clients about hedge funds is that the value that that report saw in diversification into hedge funds versus other things, and even things like property and commodities and infrastructure, hedge funds and fund of funds were way down the list of things that people wanted to invest into. And I think fundamentally that's a branding issue for hedge funds. The reality is...
I mean, you don't think it's something to do more fundamentally with the return patterns that they're offering in aggregate at the moment?
I think you can see performance as a way of overcoming that. But when you've had lackluster performance for a few years, then the reality of an asset class that, in many cases, for the average lay trustee is undesirable, unsavoury, really seems to be unnecessary given the performance issues. I think it's hard for them to look and want to move into the hedge fund space. And I think as we talk about the evolution of the industry, and Neil's talked about institutionalisation and how that might affect things, I think understanding the perception of investors when they think about hedge funds is going to be important. And I think actually one of the interesting things might be that as we start to talk more about long-short equity being part of an equity portfolio, long-short credit being part of a credit portfolio, maybe the ultimate evolution of the hedge fund industry is that we're actually not going to call them hedge funds anymore. The term hedge fund will disappear.
What are we going to call them? Exercises and free love and free riding your customers with a performance fee? Who knows? That's just one view. And Dr. Stu does not believe in the Delta of Alpha anyway. So there we are. And thanks for that, Simon. Ayuta, what's up?
Well, Dr. Stu, unprecedented call volumes have crashed the emergency hedge fund helpline.
Oh, you mean like in May 11? Not for the first time. Might be HFT, but Dr. Stu actually thinks it might be Bernie on switchboard, insisting on keeping everything on that antique of a mini computer, and he doesn't care. But Dr. Stu does, so listeners, don't despair once lines are restored. Anyway, Gus, what's going on with you?
Well, a few little tidbits from the regulatory news wires, Dr. Stu, that caught my eye over the last week or so. The financial transaction tax, so this is eagerly awaited, of course, by most of the industry, certainly the high-frequency end of things. Nothing like going out of business overnight due to the latest Euro political white elephant. Of course, the French are pressing ahead, I've said they're pressing ahead with this anyway, but there's a sort of diplomatic effort underway to try and build a broader consensus among EU nations that will allow them to sort of railroad this through on a wider basis throughout the EU. One country short of the magic nine-country threshold at a meeting of finance ministers in Luxembourg last week. So watch that space. That could be coming more of a reality than one might want sooner. Picking up on John's comments, a few things from PE Street. As the presidential campaign rages in the States, carried interest and the taxation thereof is never far from the news. And the Europeans are once again throwing their respective oars into the mix in their own particular way. The French have decided that, never mind going from 15% to 35%, which is what the debate's all about in the States, why not do it properly and crack in there with 75% effective personal taxation on carried interest over a threshold of 1 million euros?
Gus, I have to find it. I say that I find, Dr. Stu finds it extremely interesting that every time you say the word French, rather than going like, ah, the French, because there are those of us who romanticize them and their culture and their garlicky breath, and the rather racist people who run the place. You sound almost sniffy about them.
75% plus there's a special social charge on the management company. So if you get those two together and get your structuring wrong, then it's actually 95%.
So that basically means stop working or emigrate.
Go romanticise that, I might say, Dr.
Whoa.
Stu. meanwhile, the Luxembourgish are going the other way with a new idea to have a proper limited partnership rather than the pretend limited partnerships that they pretend to have at the moment. Going the other way with a 10% tax on carried interest, but TIL, this is Luxembourg, so there will be strings attached. What else is going on the topic of raising government revenue? The FSA came out last week and said that rather than using the money that it fines people to reduce the annual levy on FSA-authorised firms, that money is now going to go straight into the Exchequer. So watch this space.
Well, thank gosh, since the RBS attempt to sell its branch network, Virgin aside, as a get-out, cost the Exchequer over £3 billion. They need every penny they can get.
Well, or it'll just turn into the setup you have in the States, where it just becomes another way of raising government revenue to take somebody down with a fine. I wasn't going to mention AIFMD, but it's probably hard not to. The process is raging on. I've got a little briefing here from one of my colleagues who spends all of her time in Brussels describing exactly what's happening with the decision-making process on level two. I'm afraid I've looked at it three times and I still can't make sense of it. It's drawn out, it's delayed. There's a complicated round of further political lobbying. We were supposed to, of course, have level two by now. We haven't. It's knocked back a couple more weeks. This, of course, is the critical thing, the sort of 500 pages of regulation, which is going to have direct effect and tell us, we hope, at least to some degree, how to make sense of the level one directive. Fingers crossed a couple of weeks, but watch this space.
But Gus, at the very least, the AIFMD has given us Dr. Stu's second favourite industry or regulatory acronym. Dr. Stu loves FATCA. It's so onomatopoeic and evocative. Look at all those FATCAs. Anyway, we're going to come back to this and what the others have been saying very shortly, but something needs to be said by Aita. Quite important.
Thanks, Dr. Stu. Here it is. Listeners, beware. The Naked Short Club is neither intended to advertise nor to promote anything. So, do not act on what you hear. Unless you're an expert, accredited, qualified, or professional investor, always seek regulated advice before investing. Do not pay the blindest bit of notice to what you hear here.
Thanks, Anita. But there should be some good stuff as well as lots of free love and alpha pills this week in Paris, where Dr. Stu will be chairing at the Game Ops conference. But now Beverly is at the bar with Richard. We'll bring her back shortly when we throw what everyone else has been saying open to general discussion. But first of all, some of you do need to slow it down with a Ponzi. It's strong stuff, and in particular, Neil, Simon, Gus need to slow it down. So while you sober up, Mr. Chris Dixon, let's have some more music. Welcome back to the Naked Short Club. That was free, and I am Dr. Stu, your host. Now, our guests have raised lots of issues. They've also, not least Richard and John, overdone it with the Ponzi, rather, but lots to talk about. So let's pick up on what people were saying earlier. Now, Beverly was at the bar with Richard earlier, getting another round of the delicious products of our sponsors, made of premium Ponzi beer, when it was time for her to speak. So, Beverly, what do you make of things?
Dr. Stu, you know, performance so 2011 2012 is the more pressure you for some level 2 for example has a level 2 for some more has a for some because you have a lot Luxembourg. Tunt ist du Institut in le nexi blopofa in brochian della brdella blopofinda che spro manje chasita per so flacha e nikral nikral posion no for pecen ja nikral for so pacientia e so for pacientri so volo mo chanda bi so for pacaki so for petichando for malacini cosa frambo for bambo si treme calanta e frocha.
Yeah, I'm not sure about the bit about Luxembourg, but broadly speaking, I think most of us would agree. But Richard wants to say something here.
I was very curious to hear from you, Gus, that if the European Union was one country short of the necessary nine to talk about a to get a financial transaction tax up and running, who would the eight?
So, in no particular order, Greece, Portugal. Both countries with buoyant high-frequency trading operations.
And financial sectors.
And financial sectors. Austria, Slovenia, Belgium, Germany, and, of course, the French.
My, my.
You managed to say the French quite straight there. Wow. That's something. Now, I know Simon wanted to say something.
Dr. Stu, I wanted to answer Neil's question from earlier about why institutional investors aren't running away from hedge funds at this point in time, given that performance has been pretty muted. And I think it's certainly true that some hedge funds have made a calculated decision to keep risk low at this point in time so that they can't lose a lot of money because that will drive people away. But I think why are people staying? In reality, the people that have invested today in hedge funds have done so after a lot of hard work, a lot of graft, to get comfortable with the asset class and to understand really what it's going to deliver. And they can understand the environment that we're in today, and they can understand why the performance has been muted to a large extent. So the beauty of institutional investors and why they're attracting interest from hedge funds is that they do that work and they can then live through and work through a period of weaker performance. I think if the industry continues to deliver weaker performance, that will clearly be a problem for them in the long term. Quite frankly, I don't expect that to be the case. The industry and the rationale for why they'll deliver returns is robust, and I can't believe that the performance won't come back at some point soon.
I would have to offer a contrary view there, because we've seen in the last 5 years that a lot of so-called hedge funds are in fact closet index trackers. They lose money when the market goes down. They make money when the market goes up. Not inevitably, but that's the tendency. But they're not even very good at being closet index trackers, because now with the S&P up, or many of the other world markets up so substantially this year, hedge funds are not. They're up, but very little. And if my suggestion from my musing on my sunbed in Spain proves to be true, which is that we are in for colossal volatility, the likes of the last 5 years of which will seem modest in the 5 years to come, then I wonder whether or not the hedge funds that are the leaders now, that are the leaders of the pack, which are the chief attractors of assets, will be able to keep up any kind of performance at all. Anybody got a thought?
Well, if I can just pick up on that, Richard, I take the point that many, or some, do effectively track the index. But we've had a lot of talk this evening about hedge fund performance generally. And the idea presumably follows from that, that some institutional allocators and pension trustees and so on look at this general performance when deciding on whether or not they're going to have hedge funds in their portfolio. And isn't that a little bit like just looking at cars generally when you're trying to work out which car to buy, or talking about football teams generally didn't do very well this weekend, so I don't think I'm going to go and support one. Don't you need to just ferret out the nuggets? And why should do institutional allocators really think like that? Yeah.
Well, Gus, I mean, you took the words out of my mouth, I think. Though I must say, I agree very strongly with Beverly's comments a bit earlier. I thought they were very well put. So, my view on performance is in 2008, and I think we sat in this studio and debated it, everybody was complaining because funds were down and some funds were gating and locking investors in and so forth, and there was a lot of heat raised on that issue. People were upset, and perhaps rightly so in some cases. But at that time, the returns from hedge funds may have been down, but they were an awful lot better than from anything else. And there was huge dispersion at the individual fund level, which is exactly what Gus is talking about. So many of the bigger funds came through 2008 in very good shape. What's happened since then is they've got bigger again because they came through that well. And I guess the institutional investors have looked at what happened in retrospect and decided that that gave them downside protection, which goes back to what Simon was saying. And perhaps at the moment, with the volatility that Richard's talking about maybe ahead, perhaps it is a good thing that they're not taking a lot of risk and that performance is muted at the moment, because if they're taking a lot of risk, suddenly some of them could go down a lot as well, perhaps. Maybe Richard doesn't have that view.
Perhaps another way of looking at it is that QE implies asset price inflation, and if our other colleagues on this panel are correct, that will continue in some form for quite a period of time. And hedge funds are quite right. They're all about protecting some degree of downside that may occur. But that will imply that the market will trajectory upwards generally, but on a very risky basis. And quite rightly, hedge funds will seek to probably be more conservative. And therefore, if my colleagues are right on their assessment, then it's likely that hedge funds as a whole will probably underperform against other asset classes based on equity over the next 4 or 5 years for that very reason. It's protecting downside, not enhancing upside. So, you could see some tremendous underperformance versus other indices. And so I suspect you'll just get reallocations. It's not an asset class that will disappear. But you go through booms and busts in industries, and this has seen a boom time. It's had a slight reduction, and I'm sure it'll be a shakeout going forward as well. It happens in all industries.
Hi, Richard, back here again. Thanks, John. But I guess my point is that all of this asset allocation tends to be backward looking. I mean, most of the decisions that everybody makes about every aspect of life tends to be backward looking. But once in a while, you're given the chance to look forward. And I'm suggesting that what we might see in the next few years is not a continuation of quantitative easing, but a realization that it has been a disaster sometime in the next 18 months, and then an abrupt reversal, a slamming on of the brakes, and then a collapse in asset prices having zoomed and then crashed, and then more QE to pick them back up again, a kind of a reinforcement, a magnification of the normal behavior of central banks. And so I think that this is not a confident forecast. I just think that it's a very strong possibility that the asset price movements of the next few years will be very violent. And I suppose my question is, looking forward to that possibility, do we think that the necessary skills exist in the hedge fund sector? Because it's not a question of taking risk. Because risk, you can take risk by not being in the market. You can seek risk actively by choosing risky assets. We all know how to play that particular game. But I'm suggesting that if we've seen stock markets halve and then double, and then halve and then double, that could be a routine volatility from now on. It could be much, much greater in future. Who's got the skills? Who's got the stomach?
I think the reality is that there are two ways that institutional investors look for diversification. One is about trying to diversify the sources of return. Equities aren't going to give you a 4% risk premium over all conditions. And if you can find other things that can give you a return that's independent of that, then that helps diversify the fundamental risk of your portfolios. I think if you're talking about dealing with tail events and with the sharp volatility that you mentioned, then you have to think about different sorts of strategies within that. Now, maybe that's explicitly tail risk hedge funds that are going to protect you in those real extreme movements. We've clearly seen a big growth in the attraction of CTAs. I was a big supporter of CTAs back before the crisis, and clearly there's been more money coming in now. But they do provide you with a different return stream. I think they give you a less rich source of returns, but I think they give you a diversification that you don't get from other styles of hedge funds. But in practice, it's two different risks that you're dealing with there. One is how are you going to get your return over the long term, and the other is how are you going to manage through those periods of volatility? If you try and wrap it all up into one, I think that becomes very confusing for investors. I think that's arguably one of the reasons why they've lost faith with hedge funds, because they thought they were going to offer big downside protection, in fact upside when everything collapsed, as well as giving a long-term risk premium. And they can't do both. You have to take risk or you have to protect for it. And I think it's that...
If they can get the markets right. And it's the ability to make confident and accurate forecasts, which I think has been called into question by the last 5 years. And definitely, looking back over those 5 years, backward-looking, as I've just criticised people for being, looking forward, I don't have any confidence that people have the necessary skills to forecast the perhaps even greater asset price movements of the next few years. Don't fight over the microphone,
gentlemen. Neil and I both want to come back on this. The reality is, and it's been said already, is that the average hedge fund probably isn't any good at doing that and is probably taking a lot of fees for not adding any value. But you've got to go out there and find the ones that are good, and then you can find people that can add value. But it's very tricky to predict these things.
Neil.
Yeah. I think the point I was making about performance earlier, over the last 5 years, there are certain styles of hedge funds that have gone nowhere. Equity long short, for instance, has gone nowhere over 5 years. But there are lots of funds that have delivered good returns, which was Gus's point before. And assets have tended to flow to them. There's been a concentration of assets in certain funds.
Richard, you don't need to worry about the wild fluctuations in asset prices. We all know that that's driven by these terrible black box strategies out there ramming through 3 gazillion orders per minute, per second even. Do not worry. My spies in Brussels tell me that help is soon at hand. The Commission has this firmly in the crosshairs. They're standing by to inject a dose of regulatory Valium into the markets. I think we're probably going to end up back in the old Bombay system, where trades had to be written in triplicate on a piece of paper and carried by wheelbarrow from one jobber to the next before they could be put on. That should do the trick.
I'll just pick up a couple of points. I'm not sure QE will be stopped so quickly, because as the real world, if you stop QE, you know, the effect on asset prices and the consequential effect on the banks will be ginormous, and they can't afford that one again. So I think they can be very cautious about taking off the brakes. Secondly, you know, yes, there's a lot of quants out there. Some people have been pretty smart. Some have been lucky. It's in every industry. I think the issue perhaps was brought up is that it is mostly backward-looking, and the smartest guys in the world can be fooled. Look at LTCM. And if you have LTCM on a magnified scale, or a Lehman-type scale, you've got major, major problems in the system. So I think, you know, if there is enhanced volatility in the markets in the next few years, that could be extreme problems. You need circuit breakers, that's for certain.
Okay, I know Neil wants to round things off for the moment because we are under time constraints. We all have flights to catch in about 20 minutes or so. Neil.
Yeah, just CTAs were mentioned earlier, and I think this is obviously reflecting where a lot of the money, the backward-looking way that investors look at the lessons from the previous market. 2008, they were up a lot. The assets in CTAs in Europe have gone from 10% of the industry to 25%. This year, CTAs are down, and that's what's dragging the composite down, because they're a big chunk of the industry.
How dare they do that to us and our numbers. Anyway, thanks for that, everyone. We may well have a chance to come back to some of this later, but in any case, blow Dr. Stu down with a feather. He has not had a clue what any of you were talking about. Anyway, at least it sounds like we're all making money, which in itself makes us morally sound. Else, why on earth would we each be blessed with the country estates on the ground, yachts on the sea, and in the sky, the private jets? Speaking of money, here's an important word from Aita. Aita?
Thanks, Dr. Stu. Listeners, not-for-profit Resonance FM is thriving. We have been the UK National Radio Academy's Station of the Year for 3 years running. We had 5 shows, including the Naked Short Club, up for the last Sony Awards. But we really need your support. Resonance depends on grants and your donations. So if you value this unique voice of the particular and the unexpected, make your company a corporate sponsor and reach over 2 million listeners in the UK and around the world. Or make a donation, as so many other listeners do, via www.resonancefm.com.
Thanks, Aita. And listeners, that secure donation helps to ensure the future of the station, and as well as donating to or sponsoring Resonance, you can also become a friend of Resonance FM. Go to our website for details. Now, Mr. Chris Dixon, our master engineer, let's have some more music. Welcome back to the Naked Short Club. That was Harmonia with Eno, and I am Dr. Stu, your host. Now, Aita, what's the latest on the emergency hedge fund helpline situation?
Well, Dr. Stu, the word from David on switchboard is no green light. The IT support teams generously provided by RBS and Santander can't seem to agree what the problem is.
Well, as Dr. Stu was saying before, that sure kills off that branch disposal, and it is $3 billion less in the exchequer for Osborne and his learner drivers to play with. Anyway, time, as I was saying earlier as well, is tight. So Dr. Stu is off to Paris, where he'll be chairing at Game Ops. And if you like Ops, Game Ops is tops. See the creme of our listeners there. So let's continue within our time constraints with the earlier discussion, starting with Gus.
Yes, Dr. Stu, tax havens. I mentioned that. What springs to mind, my guess, is palm trees, sunshine and sea. Well, the good people at Griffith University in Australia have just locked a whole bunch of research students in a room and got them to send over 7,000 emails to over 182 countries, 3,700 corporate service providers and law firms to attempt to set up shell corporations in said 182 countries without disclosing proper and full information about the beneficial owners of those shell companies, which, as we will all know, is rule number one when it comes to anti-money laundering, anti-terrorism and generally avoiding financial crime. What was top of the list? Flying colours, absolutely impenetrable, unable to open an account without proper disclosure, the Cayman Islands. Saved from the very bottom of the list by Kenya, guess where? United States.
Whoa, quite an amazing thing. Now, Simon, in a second, we'll go over to you, but Beverly, I know you want to comment on that.
Bastion o gas i siomriad sy'n seth ar y ffysiel, cos mwyn i o'r i beth yw'n dafel a thranda. Eich mor y cos y caiman, cos ffram y toes o wyes, bo stori yna ffa investiwch o na mor stori eich yn ta, e ffrwblau cynnir eisti chi ffa. Bryn to costio mor y bryn ti yn o sefrlau asetio mor stori yn ta ffa.
Gus, I don't want to steal your thunder in replying for that, but I do want to come back on Richard very briefly. Richard, you talked about needing to find manager skill, and I fully agree with that. But the one thing I would also say is that it's not just about having to find one inspirational manager. People out there allocating should realise there are opportunities to capture the beta in the hedge fund space, not market beta, but the niche and alternative betas out there. And there's value to be had investing in hedge funds without just finding one magical investor to manage your money.
Neil?
Yeah, I mean, I think the other point that underlies that is that if we say that hedge funds are lagging equities this year, for many institutional investors of the type that Simon advises, that might be just fine. They've got all the exposure to equities that they want, probably already. That's not what they're buying them for. We had a big corporate pension at our recent event at the British Museum, and the man picking the funds, he said, it doesn't matter what the return is, it's simply whether we can pay the pensions. The return could be LIBOR plus four, and that would be fine, as long as it pays the pensions.
Cool. Anyway, time is money, and I need to stop us all there. So quick as a flash trade, because Dr. Stu will free ride this trade. Let's ask everyone, where would you invest your money over the next 12 months, and why, starting with Neil?
I think the things that are most out of fashion, which is equity long short.
Okay, Richard.
I continue to like anything German, especially real estate in the major cities. But also, I think that there's a play in emissions. The European allowances, the carbon certificates that have been traded for a long time, are a marginal play on European industrial production. And certified emission reductions are a marginal play on those. So you can buy those on margin. So you can get a 3x marginal margined play on CERs, which are at about currently 92% discount to their average price of 2 years ago. So worth a punt, I think.
Beautiful. Simon?
I'm a simple consultant. I'm, to be honest, an equity bull at this point in the cycle. I think that's the place to go with your money.
Okay, Gus.
European high-yield debt. Look at what's happening with the banks. I think that's a place to look at.
Okay, John.
Well, not being a hedgy, I've got no real definitive views, but I think I would short US Treasuries.
And finally, Beverly.
Questiono poi se Francio entra verso US button for opportunità.
Okay. Well, it does sound like at least most of you will be even richer than when we started, and it's just a reflection of the way in which the wealth polarization in all regions of the world, save Laytime, is intensifying. All Dr. Stu would ask is just share some, just a crumb of the 20, with Resonance FM. Now, thanks to you. Great guests. Even if a couple of you probably do need your stomachs pumped. Neil Wilson, Richard Edwards, John Foyer, Gus Black, Beverly Foyer, Simon Fox, and, as always, to master engineer Chris Dixon. Special thanks. And also, Nurse Aita Igodaro. Great job keeping our patients calm and within the conceit of the therapy. And to call us to the Emergency Hedge Fund Helpline. You're brave and special. And we hope to have it working again next week. And finally, to our sponsors, Madoff Premium Ponzi Beer, LTCM Six Sigma Waffles, Barclays, LIBOR Fix You Like, and Standard Chartered Iranian Sanctions Busting Hand Creams. We make love to all of you and your products. Finally, till next time, just remember, doing as you would be done by and loving kindness are all that really matter. The rest is just commentary.